All right, we're going to go ahead and get started. If everyone could take their seats here in the room. Okay, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Beth Kidder. Hi, everyone. If you could go ahead and take your seats, we're going to get started. All right. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Beth Kidder with the agency, and I'm the Assistant Deputy Secretary for Policy and Quality. Justin Senior is out of the office today, traveling for work, and so he's asked me to help lead our group today. Thank you all for those who are here in person. Carla, if you could go ahead and please call the roll.
Sure.
Jennifer Lang.
Here.
Marcy Hydakovich.
Here.
Ellen Anderson. Amy Guinan. Dr. Catherine Moffitt. Dr. Thacker. Dr. Payne.
Here.
Stanley Whitaker.
Present.
Ms. Martha Pierce. Iris Wimbush. Sarah Sequencia.
Do we have a quorum?
No, we don't.
Okay. I believe we can go forward with the public meeting aspect of this. So we have a full agenda today. We have a couple of aspects of this that which are public, our public forums. They're called post-award forums, and that's post-award of the waivers. So we have two waivers that are that we'll be talking about today and getting public input on. So the first is for the Managed Medical Assistance Program, and the second is for the family planning. Each of those is scheduled for an hour because they are a formal part of our waiver process. We need to notice them separately, and they have each been noticed separately. And because they are a formal public meeting, they are for an hour each. And so we will stick to those time frames. If we should get done sooner, we may take a little break or go on to other advisory committee business. If we they do have to each end at their allotted time period, though. So with that, I'll go ahead and get started. Each of them will start with just an overview of the program and some of the things that are new about the program, some findings from the program. And we'll try to get through those as quickly as possible so that we can get onto the public input portion of it. So with that, I'm going to present the first one on the Managed Medical Assistance Waiver. So just a quick overview, what I'm going to give you is just a little bit of background on Medicaid and kind of how it works. I think most people here know that, so I will go fairly quickly through it. Some of the features of Managed Medical Assistance, or MMA as I'll call it. Some of our early successes. The program has really only been in effect now for about a year and are fully rolled out for about a year, but we do have some early data coming in that's very encouraging. And we'll talk about that. And then we have some amendments that are with federal CMS right now for awaiting approval. And we'll go through that just so everyone has that on their radar. Okay, so first and foremost, I think most people here know that Medicaid is a state and federal partnership. It is a state can, if a state chooses to have a Medicaid program, they have to follow certain standards, that is certain covering certain eligibility groups, covering certain services. These are mandatory. And then there's a whole menu of other kinds of things that states can add in terms of eligibility or services. It is an entitlement program, so meaning that if a person meets the eligibility criteria, we must enroll them in the program if they apply, and we must provide all medically necessary services for them within our coverage scheme. So, again, federal law requires certain groups be covered and certain services be covered. But then state legislatures usually set the rest of the parameters for each state's Medicaid programs as long as they meet certain minimum standards. And some of the important ones, especially for some of the things we're talking about today, have to do with children and supplying all medically necessary services to children and to pregnant women. We and no state can stop providing services just because of a budget problem or freeze eligibility. because of budget issues. So with that, sometimes the issue of cost control comes up, and so what do states have at their disposal in terms of being able to control costs of a program that's an entitlement? We can sometimes and have sometimes reduced reimbursement to providers. We can eliminate optional services for adults. We can eliminate optional eligibility groups. These are all pretty drastic solutions. And we can implement delivery system reform. And this is something that we've done continually throughout our history. Perhaps the most sweeping reform that we've done has just been implemented, and it's the one we're talking about today, which is statewide Medicaid managed care. So the statewide Medicaid managed care program, or SMMC, has two components, long-term care and managed medical assistance. Almost all Medicaid, or the vast majority of Medicaid recipients, are in managed care now. This was an implementation we rolled out during 2013 and 2014. So it's just over a year now that we've been fully implemented. And this was designed to incentivize higher quality care without causing inflation. So now on to the encouraging results. So while our program is at a point where historically it is serving more people than it has ever served before, we are closing in on 4 million recipients, this increase has driven up the overall cost of the program, no doubt. But we are also serving people more efficiently than we ever have before. And you can see that on this chart by the evidence of the annual per person cost has been going down steadily over the past several years. So that is encouraging as we become more efficient and ensure we deliver care at the right time, in the right place, so that we avoid the most major costs whenever possible. Now, those of you who have been following this, which most of you probably have, know some of our goals for the Medicaid program, for the Managed Medical Assistance Program, which is to improve coordination of care, improve the health of recipients, not just paying for people when they're sick, not getting them at the end when they've already in a crisis, but trying to keep them healthy, do the best practices, get immunizations, get well child checkups, get people to the doctor for screenings, and managing their chronic conditions. So all of our incentives are aligned that way with this program. Our enhanced accountability, allowing recipients a choice of benefits and benefit packages, extra services, and then allowing the plans the flexibility to provide additional services. And then finally, of course, we're always focused on ensuring that taxpayer dollars are not going to waste through fraud and abuse. So that is always a point of focus as well. So I'll go through kind of each of these design elements. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this menu of services or of design elements, but go right to it. So one of the big design elements of SMMC is plan choice, and not just choice of any plans, but choice of high-quality plans. And so in addition to having what we call standard plans and comprehensive plans, which also provide the long-term care benefit, there are also specialty plans that serve targeted populations, and these are available in most of the different areas of the state. We have child welfare plan for children in the care of the state, Children's Medical Services Network for medically complex children, people with HIV/AIDS, and people with serious mental illness. All of our plans are fully accredited by a nationally recognized accrediting body. In addition, we were able to negotiate through the competitive bidding process additional benefits that are provided by our plans at no additional cost to the state. And some of these that are particularly popular are the adult dental benefits, additional hearing and vision coverage, such as extra pairs of eyeglasses or hearing aids, expanded outpatient hospital coverage, and expanded physician services and practitioner services coverage, among many others. There's a whole menu that you've probably seen before. And then again, it also doesn't help to have services if people can't get to them. So we have enhanced access standards as well. Both time and distance standards, when we talk about that means that there are standards for how long it can take somebody to get to a doctor. They have to have doctors and other kinds of providers within a certain period, within a certain drive time or distance. We have ratios to ensure that there's enough providers for the amount of recipients in the area. And also increased numbers of primary care providers who have expanded office hours and who are accepting new patients, both primary and specialty care. We've had an extremely low level of complaints. For the size of the program, we've been reporting on complaints to this group. We will do that again today later in the agenda. But this is we have a very low level of complaints for a program of this size. So we're very pleased with that, how that's been. And here's some actual data on the enhanced access. This is a chart that shows the participating physician and dental provider participation. So these are providers who have billed and paid for at least one service in the past year, so they are actually active in the program. And it's broken down showing from November 2013 to June 2015 how many were participating in the program. So overall, total doctors, we have a 7.4% increase in those participating, and also a 23% increase in the number of dentists participating. So I think this is good news for everybody who's been concerned that people might not be able to get providers. We are seeing a considerable growth in the number of enrolled and registered providers. So another part of another feature of the program is enhanced transparency. So one of those that we've talked about perhaps endlessly till you're sick of it is our complaint hub, which we created for the implementation of statewide Medicaid managed care so that we could help streamline the handling of complaints and issues that people had, questions that they had about the program, track them all, make sure that they were tracked to resolution, and then also look for trends, whether it was with a particular type of service or whether it was a particular plan or provider, or excuse me, plan. We also have started a series of quarterly reports, sorry for those on the phone, but I'm holding them up right now. They look like this. They're on our website. They're not in booklet form on the website, but we'll pass these around. If you all have not seen them, they're excellent resource. We're releasing these quarterly, and these will be up-to-date information on the progress of the SMMC program. They're like data books. They have a lot of information, a lot of graphs and charts in them. The first two reports have been published. They are on our website. If you have trouble finding them, let us know. And we'll continue to provide those kind of analyses and the kind of questions that people have about the program and try to publish these on a regular basis. And then finally, on enhanced transparency, all the members of the Medical Care Advisory Committee participated last year as we designed our health plan report card, which was the first kind of consumer-focused information about the quality of our health plans. And they can now use that to help them choose their plans based on the quality and how they've done on various quality measures. The report cards include ratings on how the health plans are doing on things like pregnancy-related care and children's-related care, how they're managing chronic conditions. The next section talks a little bit about quality and the kinds of things we're doing to enhance the quality of care. Again, we don't want to just pay when somebody gets sick. We want to be actively involved in helping people keep and maintain their health. So we start by collecting good data on that. Encounter data is simply a record of a transaction from a health plan, their payment for a service, just like we get claims data for fee-for-service. And we get these, and we've been getting this since 2008. But we are beginning to use it more and more for all aspects of the SMMC program. So it's critical that data is high quality, and we're working very hard to make sure that it is. The next is a set of performance measures known as HEDIS, which stands for Healthcare Effectiveness Data and Information Set, which is why we call it HEDIS for short. It's a very long name. But this is published by the National Committee for Quality Assurance. These measures are designed and periodically updated by them. And they are used by about 90% of health plans of all kinds, commercial, Medicare, Medicaid plans across the nation to help keep track of quality of care. So they have very detailed specifications. I mean, the manuals are inches thick. They're extremely detailed. And the reason for that is so that you really can be sure that one plan is measuring it the same as another plan, so you can do an apples-to-apples comparison. These results are also audited, and so we can ensure that the health plans that are calculating these they're being overseen by an NCQA certified auditor who makes sure that they have the proper processes in place to collect these calculate them correctly, and then once they are actually calculated, the auditors have to oversee them and certify them before they're submitted to the agency. So we have an assurance that they are valid numbers. There's a lot of fine print on these slides. I didn't put this much detail on, I promise you. So I will not go through all this, but basically what the NCQA does is takes data from all the health plans that report into them and group them and rank them and put them into percentiles based on how well they're doing on all of these measures. And so they calculate a measure for Medicaid, for example, called the means and percentiles on each of the different measures that are out there. So then we use those to compare the plans to other our health plans in Florida in Medicaid to other Medicaid plans nationally to see how they're stacking up. And if they don't at least meet the 50th percentile, there are penalties that can apply and damages that can be applied. So our plans submit their, we're usually about 6 months to a year behind on HEDIS data because all the claims have to come in and be paid and calculated and so forth. So we get our scores in for the previous year on July 1st. So we do have all the data in from 2014 now. And we then aggregate those scores across our plans and come up with a weighted mean for the state. So we can get kind of a scorecard for our state as a whole. How is our managed medical assistance program doing? Can you get me back on the right spot? Okay. So the very important slide I was about to show you will come soon. Just wanted you to get excited about it. For those on the phone, we've lost our technology briefly.
It's probably the one right
behind. It is 22. Okay. So what you're about to see on the screen is a large increase in the number of measures that we have that are at or above the national mean. That means we're doing much better on that. So the years of comparison are the years 2013 to 2014. In 2013, we had 41% of our measures that were at or above the national mean. Last year, in 2014, we increased to 65% of our measures being at or above the national mean. And for most of the rest of them, where we did not reach the national mean, then we had a large increase. We had improvement. So we are definitely going in the right direction with all of our quality measures. It is really an amazing, especially if you consider that this was a transition year. When plans were focused on bringing in a lot of new members, some of them are changing their service areas, recruiting new providers and so forth, this was an excellent indication they did not take their eye off the ball on quality, and it's a tribute to everybody who's put a lot of focus on this. Okay. So that is the good news. We do have a couple of amendments in. Our current waiver expires in 2017. And we do have the low-income pool. I think most of you know we're continuing to negotiate with the federal government. We're on temporary extensions of that currently. Taking away my clicker. I'm no longer authorized to advance my own slides. Okay. Oh, okay. Okay, good. I thought I killed it. All right. So this is called what's called an 1115 waiver, which for those of you who don't speak Medicaid numbers speak, that just means it's a research and demonstration waiver. And it also comes with certain requirements, like that anytime we do an amendment, we need to give the public 30 days notice and the ability to comment on it. So for each of the amendments I'm about to describe, we have gone through that process. We've received public comment. We've considered it. And we've now submitted it to CMS, and most of them we expect to be approved very quickly, or in the very near future. Okay, the first one is an expansion to the populations that can choose managed medical assistance. There were some populations, very few, that were excluded and could not choose MMA. And last year, the year session before last, the legislature expanded that group to include children who are receiving prescribed pediatric extended care or PPEC services, and individuals in a group home. And so that amendment would just allow those people to have that additional choice. The next one is what we call express enrollment. This will allow people, will have people enroll in managed care immediately upon eligibility determination. So within likely about a day of eligibility determination, they will be in a managed care plan. They will not have a period of waiting in fee-for-service while they go into a plan. On the back end, they'll have the opportunity to choose before they go in. But if they don't or if they're not happy with their choice, they'll have 120 days after they're enrolled to change plans. And then finally, but not least, the low-income pool. And this is redesigning elements of the low-income pool and extending the program till the end of the waiver in June of 2017. The redesigned LIP program ensures access to care for low-income populations that are not eligible to participate in Medicaid or any other kind of subsidized coverage. And it complements the MMA program by strengthening the connections between critical safety net providers in the MMA program. And then last, we do have an evaluation of the waiver that is ongoing. That is a requirement of 1115 waivers. We have an independent evaluator, usually a state university. In this case, it is the University of Florida, working on a waiver evaluation. And this is kind of redesigned along the way as we amend different portions of the waiver. Some parts of the evaluation close out because those elements are no longer there, and then we add new elements. So it's kind of a rolling evaluation that evolves as the waiver itself evolves. So that concludes the presentation. We're at the point where we are looking for input. I don't know, Carla, do we have a speakers list or a...
Yeah, probably.
Okay. So we will take public comment. Do we want people to come up to...
We've got a mic that will be walked around.
Okay, so we will come to you. When we call on you, please raise your hand. We'll bring you a microphone. It's important you speak into the mic so that people on the phone can hear. We do have people on the phone, and then there will be a point where the operator assists us with anybody on the phone who would like to make comments. Okay, great. All right, we're going to start with Brian Andrews, and after that, Dr. Payne. Don't have anything? Okay. And then Jared Fowler from FMA, just so you all know kind of where you are in the queue.
Good afternoon. Brian Andrews, Chief Administrative Officer at Lake EMS. We are a county-based emergency services provider in Lake County, providing ambulance service for both emergency and non-emergency. The reason I'm here today, in addition to Mark Postman that I'll speak with in a minute, is just some suggestions. Actually, on our way here, we saw there's a new rulemaking session coming up where it looks like they're proposing to separate ambulance back out like it was years ago and putting us back in with the wheelchair and stretcher providers. But we've encountered a number of issues with the plans and with the authorization process, prior authorization, and I encourage you going forward. One thing, you know, where can you improve? Put some enforcement on the hospitals. In our case, the hospitals and nursing homes are required to get the authorization before they're supposed to call the transportation brokers to get the authorizations. And what the hospitals have quickly figured out in our area is if they call us for non-emergency and we tell them they need that, they hang up and 10 minutes later call us back and all of a sudden it's an emergency. There needs to be an example in Texas. The providers work with the Medicaid program there, and they put language in their rule that says if the hospitals don't get the prior authorization, they have to pay the bill. Because it's about managing services, and right now what's happening is we're being put, and we're doing those trips for free because the hospital says it's an emergency. We have an obligation to take an emergency patient. We get there. Patients aren't ready to go.
We appreciate that.
We're losing lots of money.
Yeah, we'll follow up with you on the example from Texas for how they work.
Yep, and we are a tax-funded entity, so any money that we don't get from the Medicaid program comes from the taxpayers in our county, and that's a huge issue.
Thank you. Okay. Jared Fowler is next.
Hey, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. Just real quickly, on behalf of the Florida Medical Association, we'd just like to remind the agency of the importance of the physician pay increase that's scheduled to go into effect next year as part of the MMA program. As you know, Medicaid fee-for-service rates have historically been very low, often inadequate for physician providers. It's led to low participation rates in the past, and the MMA program is supposed to correct this by requiring all physicians to be paid at or above Medicare rates by the health plans going into effect throughout next year. And so we hope that the agency intends to enforce this requirement and that the plans intend to comply with it. Again, we feel that it's extremely important to ensuring access to care under the program, and that we believe it's an extraordinarily important part of the program in general. And we look forward to working with the agency to make sure that that requirement goes into effect.
Okay, thank you very much. Next, we have Pamela Johnson. Okay, in the front. And after that will be Mark Postrom? Okay.
I am an advanced registered nurse practitioner, and I'm here on behalf of a special population that's being served at home. Many of them are dually enrolled in Medicare and Medicaid. What some of these patients have experienced is as they were enrolled into an MMA plan, especially if the MMA plan the Medicaid was their primary insurance, these people are confined to home with two, three, and sometimes more chronic disease processes that really make it extremely difficult for them to leave their house and go into an office-based setting. So more often than not, these are the people who EMS has to come and transport to the emergency room just to get primary care. And it's people like myself and other clinicians that go into their homes, manage their primary care, and try to prevent or reduce the number of emergency room visits that are made. Once they were enrolled in MMA plans, a lot of these people were assigned a provider but can't get out, so they have no idea as to who their primary care providers are, and they've never seen them. If Medicaid was their secondary insurance, the MMA became a secondary payer source, but some of the MMA primary care providers, and I'm in Broward and Palm Beach County, some of them have never seen the patient, so let's say I go in and need a chest x-ray. The MMA won't pick up the secondary portion of cost because the patient hasn't seen the primary care provider for the MMA, although Medicare is primary, so part services aren't necessarily covered. Okay, so
I would encourage you to put any of those instances into the complaint hub. That's not a correct application of policy. And so we would want to know about that so we could follow up with the plans and enforce that.
I have on multiple occasions. I know you have record. And let me thank the agency because you provided data that allowed me to do a retrospective study over 5 years, and it affected services being provided to this population by provider type. I've given you a copy, and hopefully we can move forward and share that data and figure out a way to help these people have direct access to the continued care they need.
Thank you. Next is, can you tell me your name, sir, because I'm not getting it right from the sign-in.
My name is Mark Postma. Sorry, I'm not sure I can read this at the same time. So. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before the committee this afternoon. My name is Mark Postma, and I'm the Vice President of Paramex Plus. We're a national organization which operates EMS systems, and we operate the Sunstar EMS system in Pinellas County, Florida. I live in Pinellas County, Florida. We're the largest EMS agency in the state of Florida who provides both emergency and non-emergency services. I'm the president-elect of the American Ambulance Association, and that is the nation's largest ambulance association representing all 50 states in regards to emergency medical services, and we have a contingent here with us that represent ambulance operators. Today I appear before you as a board member of the Florida Ambulance Association to address the obstacles our Florida EMS providers are having since the implementation of the managed Medicaid managed care program, as you described. The two major problems our industry faces are, one, managed care organizations improperly denying requests for medically necessary ambulance transfers, and managed care organizations wrongly refusing to reimburse EMS providers for medically necessary services. The major problems arise when patients require transfers from hospitals to hospitals for higher levels of care, or in cases in which patients require clinical monitoring to other facilities such as nursing homes. The MMAs and their transportation brokers improperly deny authorization for these medically necessary ambulance trips, which are outlined in the manual, or send improper modes of transportation and refuse to reimburse our providers. I received the following examples from our providers of these two examples. A pregnant preeclampsia patient required transport to a different hospital for specialized OB care. She required medical monitoring during the transfer, and she had an IV. Yet the MMA wanted to transfer her via non-medical paratransport. Actually, under state law, that's actually illegal to do. You can't transport a patient with an IV in another type of transportation system. Another instance involved a 4-year-old patient who was mauled by a dog and needed plastic surgery, only available at another hospital. The broker denied authorization for the ambulance transport and advised the hospital to send the patient by cab. These are just two examples. We have many different ones from our other providers. Both of these patients should have been transported by an ambulance, as they involved medical conditions listed within the condition codes cited in the Medicaid Ambulance Provider Manual, Section 2-4. As you are aware, prior to May 1st, 2014, ambulance providers were able to respond to non-emergency ambulance calls without prior authorization, provided they adhered to the guidelines outlined in the Medicaid Ambulance Provider Manual. While ambulance providers are still responsible to follow the Medicaid Ambulance Provider Manual, MMA providers confuse non-emergency ambulance services for those services provided by NET, non-emergency transport providers. They are denying ambulance authorization for Medicaid patients that have both met medical necessity and condition code requirements in according to Section 2-4 of the Medicaid Ambulance Manual. The result of this managed care organizations are compromising patient care and continuity of care in what we can only guess is an effort to save money. Medicaid managed care organizations are also failing to reimburse our providers for the services provided to their members. Since the implementation of managed care organizations have been improperly denying reimbursement for mileage for out-of-county transports and transports greater than 30 miles, Medicare crossovers, and non-emergency intra-facility claims. Reimbursement for ambulance transportation involving patients who require transport greater than 30 miles has all but disappeared. These types of transports usually involve the movement of patients who require specialized services not available in the local service area. Although the Medicaid Ambulance Provider Handbook requires payment for these types of calls, transportation brokers and the MMAs refuse to pay for these services. Many of which fall under EMTALA criteria. As to Medicare crossovers, for decades and pursuant to Florida law, Medicaid paid ambulance providers for crossover claims when Medicare was primary. Medicare would electronically transfer the explanations of medical benefits to ACA's contractor for payment, and ACA would automatically pay the provider. No other steps were required by the provider. Today, MMAs and transportation brokers require providers to submit paper 8 HCFA 1500 claim forms, photocopy and attach a copy of the Medicare EOMB, and then typically deny these claims unless they were 911 calls. Not only has this forced industry back years, these additional cost requirements have increased claim submissions timeframes, driving up processing costs for providers, but more importantly has resulted in providers suffering financial from the lack of these payments. These unexpected and unfunded expenses, as well as the loss of revenue, has had a rippling effect on EMS providers throughout the state of Florida, and some providers to reevaluate their budgets and the future investments in personnel and equipment. We understand the need for the agency to control expenses. However, it should not be at the expense of patient care. We urge the agency to please reevaluate its decision to place ambulance within the purview of managed care. Keep in mind that EMS is a very small industry. At the federal level, we only represent 1% of all Medicare funds. I would imagine that's probably similar to Medicaid funds, but we're the vital safety net of the community. Anyone in here today may need an ambulance at some time in their life or on a situation just like today. Nobody really cares about ambulances and how they're funded until you need one, and all of us may need one. In fact, it's proven that in most of everyone's life, you'll go ride an ambulance twice. So with that, we would ask, we urge the agency to please reevaluate its decision to place ambulance within the purview of managed care. Thank you for your time and that would answer any questions.
Thank you. I appreciate you coming. If it's possible to get your comments, your written comments, that would be very helpful to us. If you want to, that'd be wonderful. Thank you. We appreciate it. And we encourage you to, with all these issues, if you've not put them into the issues that we are familiar with most of the issues that you've raised, so we appreciate you coming in, giving your comments.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate your time. Yes, Alan, go ahead.
Did you say that, who told you that the transport, for somebody to take a cab, was that the health plan told, and so a health plan said take a for the patient to take a cab?
If you could maybe follow up with Ms. Anderson after the meeting, you all could talk about that. I think that that's
okay.
Something
well,
we would all want to
get
cleared up.
There is someone else, the nurse practitioner that spoke also said transportation was a problem. So can we just reiterate the fact that in health plans during under Medicaid managed care, health plans are supposed to cover transportation, correct, for these
transportation is absolutely covered, both emergency and non-emergency, and they have to follow our handbook. So. In the standards there. So these are issues that if you're having issues, we need to know timely. We need to know through our complaint hub with as much detail as you can give us so that we can trace this down, make sure that the plans are following and complying. And if there are any misunderstandings, that we can work on them as quickly as possible.
We were told to stop using the hub.
I'm sorry, can you be on the microphone, please? We do have a number of people on the phone, and they cannot hear.
I just couldn't hold my tongue. We were told to quit using the portal because we were filing too many complaints.
Well, I will speak for the agency and say that no.
Brian Andrews, Lake EMS. The 250, 500 other providers in the state of Florida.
Okay. Well, I speak for the agency in this forum, and that is not our position. Our position is that any and all complaints that you can't work out with a plan need to come to us, either through our online portal or through calling our recipient and provider assistance helpline. So we do have a number of people, I believe, on the phone. I'd like to take those first, and then if we have time, I want to make sure they get a chance to get their comments in. So, operator, do we have anyone waiting on, waiting on the line to make a comment?
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. At this time, if you wish to pose a question or a comment, please press star 1, record your name, followed by the pound sign. I repeat that, star 1, record your name, followed by the pound sign. Questions will be taken in the order received. We'll pause for a moment to compile a list.
I feel like we should have music playing or something in the background. Okay. Go ahead.
And we have no questions at this time.
Okay. Then I'll call on Stan Whitaker.
Yes, my name's Stan Whitaker. I'm with the Florida Association of Nurse Practitioners. In your handouts that you had some very interesting data on page 13. The enhanced access, increased physician, dental provider participation. It's encouraging to see that we're getting more and more providers. However, speaking from experience, I don't know that that data is solid in that nurse practitioners are not being recognized as providers of care in the managed care programs. Most of our nurse practitioners are having to get a physician to be impaneled in order for them to get patients. So when you're looking at this data where you see the MDs and DOs that are being the increase, I can't help but wonder how many of those are actually nurse practitioners who are having to get or pay for physicians to sponsor them in order for them to be reimbursed through the Medicaid managed care processes, mainly because they will not impanel or credential nurse practitioners and many of the plans. We're still having, I know y'all tired of hearing this, but it continues to be an issue. In that a lot of them are not able to be directly reimbursed from the managed care plans.
I think we could check to see whether the, because these are actually enrolled providers, and the claims that they have, I guess we could check to see if the claims that they had were filled with from services provided by an ARP working under their number. We should be able to check that to see if that's the case. But overall, these are straight up enrollment and registration numbers.
The other issue I'd like to bring forward is that, you know, we're supposed to be providers of care in the managed care program. However, we don't have an ability to track MPs or PAs in these service areas. So if there's some way that we can possibly look into some kind of tracking mechanism, that could give us a little better data as far as, you know, who's doing what, I think that'd be very beneficial, and we may actually see that a lot more of the, you know, providers coming into the program as opposed to several providers, you know, actually submitting claims under one provider, which would be the physician or the in this case. Thank you.
Operator, do we have any anyone else on the line who may have thought of a question in the interim?
Oh, we did have one question. That question comes from the line of?
Pinellas County Sunstar EMS, Pam Bell.
You may proceed.
Good afternoon, I'm sorry. We had a question pertaining to the statute. Under the statute, they talk about essential providers of 409.9751A, and because of the structure of our ambulance service here, we feel like we meet that definition of an essential provider, and we have approached ACA, and we got back a brief statement basically saying that to this point they haven't designated any regional essential providers, and I would just like to encourage and ask if there will be a process that an entity could go through if they feel like they meet this definition of the essential provider. And so that's our main comment. And secondly, we did want to comment also on the complaint portal. We have had complaints that have been closed out without resolution, which involved duplicate staff time, because when we contacted the entity, we were told we had to put them back in again. So we've had that happen several times. And we also literally have an email from someone who told us almost essentially the same thing as Brian Andrews stated, that we don't have enough staff, so don't put any more in there, that they're overwhelmed. So that's basically our comment.
So, yeah, we would love to see the email. So,
we will find it.
Okay. If there's not a good way for us to contact here, but I can give you my email address. There's also the email address that's on the public notice for this, but let me give you mine, which is Beth, B-E-T-H, dot Kidder, K-I-D-D-E-R, at ACA, A-H-C-A, dot myflorida.com. And if you find it and can send it to me, we'd be very interested in seeing that. Let me reiterate that is okay. Not the agency's position, that we take all comments. If something has been closed out inappropriately, our staff do try to get back with folks to make sure that the issue has been resolved to their satisfaction. Sometimes there's a misunderstanding about what resolution, whether satisfaction was achieved on that. So we apologize if that's happened to you. We do encourage you to continue using it, and if you have not gotten resolution, to let us, you know, to go ahead and let the hub know. And you can reference back. Maybe David should answer this. If they've had something closed out, do they have to re-enter everything, or can they just reference back and say this one was closed inappropriately, please reopen? That's the best way to handle.
I don't know exactly the context situation. I think right now all the complaints should have an individual tracking number, so they should be able to refer to a specific tracking number that's provided and just kind of pick it up from there. But I think there's might be more to the situation.
Beth, can you spell your last name again? We didn't get your full email.
Sure. It's Kidder, K-I-D as in dog, D-E-R, like just kiddering around.
Yeah.
All right. Is there anyone else on the line, operator?
No further questions at this time.
Okay. We have a few more minutes, about 15 more minutes here. Amy, you're not on the list. Go ahead. Amy Guinan.
Then after Amy, I'd like to make a comment, please.
Hi, this is Amy Guinan with Florida Legal Services. And first, I just want to start by thanking you, Beth and David, and all of your staff. This has been an incredible undertaking. It's a huge amount of work for you all, and your dedication to making sure that this program works well is so evident. And we really appreciate how responsive you've been when we've brought you issues. Beth, you mentioned in your presentation that there's an extremely low level of complaints, which is great to hear, and I definitely think it indicates that many things are working well. But I also think it's important to keep in mind that just because complaints aren't being made doesn't mean that there aren't some problems. It could also mean that people just aren't aware of the complaint process, or they simply don't know that what they're experiencing is something they can complain about, or even as was mentioned here by other speakers, that they have been told not to make complaints. So my colleagues at FLS and I have found that many of the Medicaid recipients that we've worked with, and even a significant number of providers and their staff in general, just aren't aware of some or they don't have a clear understanding of some of the major consumer protections under statewide managed care, including the timely access standards, or they're unfamiliar with the complaint hub or the health plan grievance process. Some of the most important consumer protections, such as the timely access standards, I think can be the most difficult to monitor, because even if on paper the health plans do have adequate networks, there are so many factors that can contribute to a breakdown in the process and actually result in the recipients not being able to access necessary care in a timely manner. One of the biggest problems that we've seen with nearly all clients we've worked with was inaccurate information provided by recipient or provided by either inadequately trained staff or customer service reps who have been told to approach things the wrong way or who just don't have an understanding of the timely access standards. I've also worked with clients who were given incorrect information about the referral process. And, for instance, told that they'd have to travel 200 miles to see a specialist. And I think the assumption is that when you are calling your provider or your health plan representative, customer service representative, that you're being given accurate information. So when you're told inaccurate information, you take it as true and don't complain. So I think even though complaints in certain areas may be low, we also need to consider that it could also be that recipients have just given up trying to access the care because they were given it wrong information, or they're just simply exhausted by the process. So to truly be confident that these consumer protections are working, we need to ensure that recipients know about these protections. And I think with that, we need increased consumer outreach. I think we also need to make sure that the customer service reps, other staff on the front lines, and really all of us who are working as advocates or working with recipients and are giving information about the program are really giving accurate information. And for that, we need access to the information. So while the ACA website has wonderful information, great detail in so many areas, it can often be very difficult to find. And I know that it's difficult, and there's several websites Florida Health Finder has a lot of great information too, but it's spread all over. So I would urge you to consider creating a section of the website, the ACA website, that deals with consumer issues and quality of care issues, where we know that there's just one page we can go to where we can have all of the most important consumer protections and the quality of care, and even the health plan complaint reports, as well as links to the health plan report cards you mentioned. So, thank you.
Great. Appreciate those suggestions. Dr. Payne.
Robert Payne with the Florida Dental Association. If you look at the bottom of page 13 in the report, it has a figure here that is just absolutely astounding and dumbfounding to me, and that is the total number of participating dentists in Medicaid has increased in 2 years by 23%. That goes contrary to what the public health officials tell us and what we hear in the private sector. I don't know where those figures are coming from, but that just is really astounding. And if I may, I'd like to defer to our staff member, Casey Stademeyer, to elaborate on that just for a moment.
Certainly.
Thank you, Dr. Payne. Again, I'm Casey Stademeyer with the Florida Dental Association. Before I get to that, I do just want to thank Erica and Bob. They've been great from the agency standpoint. We definitely have had growing pains as this Medicaid managed care has rolled out, and our dentists have had a lot of questions and issues. But any time that I loop in Erica and Bob, they're right there to help us get a resolution. Now, that said, to kind of echo Ms. Guinan's comments, I really shouldn't have to get involved. Our members shouldn't have to come to me to get to a decision maker at ACA. It's a great member benefit that I'm happy to provide. But if our provider is working with the plan, then the plan should be able to resolve those issues, because a lot of time it is the person on the front line not knowing what the proper, you know, response should be, or not knowing that that's something that should be covered, or et cetera, et cetera. So, again, I would just echo her remarks, because I think if I have to get involved, it's something that can usually be resolved within 24 hours when I get Bob or Erica to look into it. And quite frankly, that's just showing me that the plan should be covering it, and they probably know they should be covering it, and they aren't. So just want to kind of echo her remarks. And then to Dr. Payne's issue, yeah, that's something that we're definitely seeing in the private sector. Most of the calls I'm getting are, I want to drop out of this program. I've already told them I'm not seeing any more patients. I don't want to see any more Medicaid patients. It's becoming too much of a hassle. I know that's what I'm hearing from the public health standpoint as well. And I know really this goes to our issue of network adequacy. I know that the plans have network adequacy standards, and I know they are supposed to be reviewed and making sure they're adequate by the agency. I'm not sure. I've heard a couple of differing on when and how the networks have to be adequate, and when the plans have to submit those to the agency for review, and are they audited, et cetera, et cetera. I've heard a couple of different answers. One, that it's by contract, that they have to do it X amount of times per quarter, or, you know, yearly, or, you know, it's something on a regular basis.
It's weekly.
Yeah. Because I was in a committee meeting last session where it was said that we only a legislator had asked the question about network adequacy, and it was stated, and so you might just want to follow up, I think it was Health and Human Services, we only research network adequacy when a complaint is filed in the complaint hub. So that's just an FYI.
Well, I will tell you that that might have been a misunderstanding of either the question or the not knowing the context of what the answer was, but the plans submit their networks every week.
Okay.
To keep them updated on their website. We do have monitoring activities that are underway to test the networks to make sure that what they're putting out there are actually real networks.
And just lastly, on network adequacy, and this is something that, you know, the FDA has said time and time again, this is great that it says we have 2,319 dentists, but if we can get to that second and third question, are they taking new patients? And if they're taking new patients, is it every other Tuesday, you know, the third month of the year, or are they seeing them on a regular basis? So while we may have an increase in dentists and, you know, providers that are willing to treat Medicaid providers, what is their rate of actually accepting new patients? Is it something you can just call and you can get in and I'm seeing new patients, or I'm only going to see patients every other Tuesday type of thing? So, again, just asking that second and third question to make sure the network really is adequate. So thank you.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, we had at a meeting in the past talked about having a like an anonymous shopper go and call and see if these providers were, in fact, still active in doing that. Has that ever been done?
This is David Rogers. Dr. Payne, we are doing that. I'm going to speak a little bit more about that when we actually go over the complaints. I'll speak to that specifically on network adequacy. But let me just also say that there are a lot of measures for network adequacy, a lot of dimensions to that. So I think probably, as Beth indicated, the misunderstanding, we do that secret shopper, right? We call providers, verify if they're in the networks accepting, complaint-driven. I'm going to get into to some of a little bit more of that, again, later on today. But we do, again, weekly reporting with plans. There's other measures. Amy mentioned kind of access standards, how quickly you get into appointment. That's another measure. So there are a lot of different aspects of network adequacy that have different kind of approaches and different measurement, and you really got to look at all these different dimensions, not just one single dimension that says is a network adequate.
We have just a few minutes left. I'm going to go back. Let me just check Dr. Mr. Whitaker for just a second. Operator, are there any other callers on the line who would like to speak before we wrap up?
We have no further questions at this time.
Okay. Stan, you have the last word, I think. Oh, I'm
well, Beth, I have a call.
Okay, so we have several folks. We have about 4 minutes left on the noticed meeting on this. You are all members of the committee, so we will have more time for committee members to speak when we get into the regular business portion. So if you could maybe hold your questions, and we'll take Stan's for the last, and then we'll pick this back up just as general discussion under the regular business.
I can actually discuss this with every when we get a part in the meeting here, but basically it has to do with referrals from within for the network adequacy is that we're not seeing those referral physicians within close proximity. I know that in Region 1 and Region 2 that people are having to travel, well, specifically in my region, Region 2, they're traveling to Jacksonville, Pensacola for specialty services on a regular basis. So we can discuss that at that time.
Okay, I think we are just at the end of our time here, and so we will switch gears and go into the second publicly noticed meeting. Before we do that, there are plenty of chairs over on this side of the room for anybody over here who's cramped or not in a chair. And for a few folks by the door, if more people come in, feel free to send them across the room. There's no problem with them crossing in front or behind us during the presentation. So please, let's make sure everyone's comfortable. With that, we'll move to the second portion. We have the public post-award forum. Sorry, it's an awkward name. Post-award forum for the family planning waiver. This is scheduled for half an hour till 2:30 because we aren't expecting quite as much comment on this. But Heather, if you could go ahead. Heather Morrison on our team oversees this waiver and is going to do the presentation.
Hello, this is the post-award portion for our 1115 family planning waiver. This is a smaller waiver, and so we only have about 30 minutes for this presentation. The family planning waiver is a Section 1115 research and demonstration waiver, like the managed medical assistance waiver. But it's just much smaller. So just a little overview of Section 1115 research and demonstration waivers. It's under Section 1115 of the Social Security Act, and it gives HHS the authority to approve experimental, pilot, and demonstration projects. And it gives the states a little bit more flexibility to design and improve their programs. The current family planning waiver is in all 67 counties, so it's statewide, for women aged 14 through 55 who are losing their Medicaid coverage who have family income at or below 185% of the federal poverty level and are not otherwise eligible for Florida Medicaid, Children's Health Insurance Program, or health insurance cover that provides family planning services. Eligibility is limited to 2 years after losing Medicaid coverage, and it's subject to an annual redetermination. So these would be women who maybe got on Medicaid because they were pregnant and having a baby, and then they had their child, and then they lose their Medicaid coverage. So this is to give them 2 years of family planning services. The goal of this waiver is to increase the number of women receiving Florida Medicaid family planning services who are between the ages 14 and 55 and have income at or below 185 of the FPL. Sorry, and I'm not advancing slides. I apologize for that. The objectives of this waiver, increase access to family planning services, increase child spacing intervals through effective contraceptive use, reduce the number of unintended pregnancies in Florida, and reduce Florida Medicaid costs by reducing the number of unintended pregnancies by women who would otherwise be eligible for Florida Medicaid pregnancy-related services. The evaluation of this waiver, all 1115 research and demonstration waivers have an evaluation component. It looks at the four objectives of the waivers that we just went over in the previous slide. We contract with the University of Florida Family Data Center to complete the evaluation, and our research team is developing and submitting a draft report with information to the agency. We expect it December of this year. This specific waiver has been around since 1998. It was initially approved in 98, and our current waiver period is it was January 2015 through December 2017. So this waiver has been around for about 17 years, which is longer than most of our waivers and most 1115 waivers. The covered services for this waiver are obviously family planning services, physical exams, pregnancy tests, birth control, treatment for STDs, and pharmaceuticals, lab tests, anything family planning related women's services. This specific waiver, the program is operated by the Department of Health, and the recipient application can be accessed by going to the Department of Health's website. And the website address is below. And this is a very short presentation, and if I spoke too quickly, I apologize. I do that sometimes. if you have any questions or comments, we're going to open it up now. And I will get the list because I'm not sure if some of you noted that you wanted to make a comment. Give me just 1 second.
I didn't have anybody noting that they wanted to make a comment on this, but that doesn't preclude us. Operator, if you could go ahead and give the instructions to people who are on the line if they would like to ask questions. In the meantime, if you're in the room and you would like to, please just raise your hand and we'll come around to you.
As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, that's star one. Record your first and last name, followed by the pound sign to pose your question or comment.
Next time I'm going to have Heather do my presentation because nobody asks any questions. Next time Heather will probably be on maternity leave.
And she is family planning matters.
She has planned her family well. It's under her planning. Her efforts are underway. There. Okay. Yes, Dr. Thacker, go ahead.
Dr. Thacker and I apologize for being late on my call today and just unexpected stuff. But the in terms of the waiver that's been awarded, I see the University of Florida was mentioned, but are there other institutions that are active in participating in this and contributing to the efforts?
Dr. Thacker, on this particular evaluation, it is is the University of Florida, but we have a number of other universities that do evaluations for us on our programs. We don't necessarily competitively bid them, but we do put them out to all state universities for letters of interest. and that we work with the different ones to find the best team to work with us. So we have contracts with University of South Florida, University of Florida, FSU. I'll look to my evaluation people here. And I'm trying to think which other active ones. We've had other FIU. We have FIU. We stopped on FSU. I'll go back to UF. it's open to all universities who are interested in it. We do that because they can often bring additional matching funds to the table to draw down federal match for these evaluations. So. Operator, do we have anyone on the line with questions or comments?
We did have one question. That question comes from the line of
Joe Escambia, County EMS. And the question is for the last session, if I could still put that out.
At this point, we are on a different public meeting, different publicly noticed meeting. So we'd be happy to get your comments in writing if you'd like to go ahead and send them in on the managed medical assistance. Linda, what would be the best place for them to send those comments to? Or Heather?
The email address should have been in the FAR that was published. If not, I can say it out to you, and hopefully you can write it down. It's flmedicaidwaivers@ahca.myflorida.com. And if anybody wants to submit any comments on the Family Planning Post-Award Forum or on the MMA Post-Award Forum, you can send any of those comments or questions to that email box. Thank you.
You. All right. Anyone else? We will take a last call for comments on family planning waiver. Okay. Operator, anyone else on the line?
No further questions at this time.
Okay. All right. With that, I think I will bring this post-award forum to a close. Thank you for your interest in both of them. We will move on now to the regular business portion of, or the other business portion of the Medical Care Advisory Committee. Dave Rogers is going to talk a little bit about complaints and compliance, and I think that will be a good segue back to some of the comments that that some of you all had. I do have note that we will come back to you all on that, so maybe after David and before the bylaws discussion.
Okay, thank you, Beth. Appreciate it. You should have a couple of things, I think, members of the committee in your packet. You should have the regular kind of complaint report, the monthly report, and then as Amy kind of referenced, it is posted on our website now, but we've been bringing that to you as you've been meeting. And then we put together also just a few presentations, looks like this, although it's in color, I think, in your packet. Okay. That is kind of some representation of the first quarter of this state fiscal year, so for the first 3 months of the year. And I'll kind of walk through that, give some commentary, hit on a couple of issues that have already been noted in some of the earlier discussion. So the first is picture is a distinction between what comes in online versus what comes in through our contact center or through the telephone. We did, again, develop this complaint process, what we kind of call a complaint hub, a central intake process, as part of the rollout of SMMC. And as part of that, we developed an online form, which has gone through some various revisions over time to try to get it a little bit more effective, I guess, and efficient. I apologize for the language here. Probably doesn't mean a lot to folks. Health track complaints enter directly. Health track is simply the name of the software system that's used by our contact center representatives, the folks that answer the phones from recipients and providers. Again, they're taking those complaints via the phone and entering them into the system directly. We had been encouraging, although softly, and I think that this kind of tracks with Amy's comment in terms of the need to do some outreach or the benefits of doing some outreach. But we had been encouraging folks to call us as opposed to the online form, particularly on recipient issues. The online forms have to pass. They get reviewed. Again, really, depending on what time they come in, that day or the next day. But oftentimes, particularly in regards to giving someone information, that can be done on the phone. We still log the issue, right, so that we have a record of it and we're able to still use it in our trending. But we're often able to resolve an issue, again, with the caller on the line. That's just simply not possible, obviously, on the online process. It'll kind of have to pass through someone's hands and most likely result in a call back to the individual complainant to begin with. So you can see it's been about even. We get about 1,500 issues or complaints a month, and it's been about equally split between those coming in by telephone and online. A little bit of increase in the call volume in August in terms of relative to the online form. That's a couple of things. As I said, we had been encouraging it to some degree. We've kind of reversed the order and putting the phone number first on some of our presentations before we put the website. But I think what really accounted for that increase there in terms of the calls was the exit of Univita from the Florida market. Univita was a DME, home medical equipment supplier, and had contracts with several plans, about a dozen plans, right, that exited the Florida market rather abruptly, let's say, at the end of July, right? So we did get quite a little bit of a tick up there, obviously. In terms of the complaints by program, we are tracking these issues across both MMA, the Managed Medical Assistance Program, and long-term care for SMMC. We've also started to track these for our fee-for-service program. We do have some individuals, again, that are not covered by SMMC. And so we do use this process for fee-for-service as well. You'll note that that's about 35% of our issues coming in. It's actually for fee-for-service slash other. Let me just explain that to you because it's not really intuitive. Other are generally SMMC-related issues, but they're not plan-specific issues. Examples of that might be if someone calls and the agency has them as a Medicare individual with Medicare coverage and they don't have Medicare coverage or some other third party, right? That's not a plan issue, but it could be potentially for someone in an SMMC. So those are kind of captured together. We probably would be well served to tease that out. But as you can see, most of the issues are for MMA, which you might expect, with about 3 million individuals covered under that program. And so they run about 1,000 issues a month out of the roughly 1,500 per month in total. So let's look at the types of issues. They're going to the next page. And first you have the number of MMA issues by category, and this tracks with the monthly report. And as you'll see on the monthly report, and as you've seen before, there are some subcategories, you know, that we try to break that down in terms of how we classify these. Most of them are in regard to payment. The majority are in regard to payment. And I think with some of the comments earlier, particularly in areas that were not previously covered under managed care, prior to SMMC, transportation, substance abuse, hospice, all of those I think have been areas where they've significantly influenced that, and it continues to be fairly high in relationship to service-related issues or complaints regarding network adequacy or customer service issues. Let me mention a couple things on the payment side. I think I've mentioned to the committee before that we have established kind of a specialized unit in our Fort Lauderdale office to handle just the payment issues. It's been, I think, a bit of a challenge to go through the transition after rollout. So again, rollout, where you will probably, hopefully, all recall that one of the key success criteria for us was to ensure that providers get paid, being sensitive to cash flow in terms of the rollout, right? As we've kind of gone to steady state, really we've tried in the complaint process to focus on compliance issues with the plans. Plans do not pay the same way that Medicaid pays. And we don't apply, for example, everything in our handbooks, like our fee schedules to managed care plans, or even mileage, right, for transportation providers. It's dependent on the contract between plans and providers. So again, particularly for providers that had not previously been in managed care, not exclusively, but we've tried to kind of dial that to where, again, we can determine if there's a need for training. These are not always easy to do, to find out what's underlying, right? And when there might be a compliance issue, right, that we actually need to probe further on the plan, whether they're not paying providers in accordance with the contractual expectation. So that's been a bit of a shift for both us internally in terms of our staffing, and I think for providers as well. We're real fortunate. I know I see Celeste here and for Alcohol and Drug Abuse Association is going to be working with us on a kind of a how-to, you know, best use that complaint process. And we've worked with hospice, Paul Ledford, Chrissy Grant, I think, in terms of working with them and doing surveys of their members where we could find mechanisms to kind of collect information from providers in mass. On the provider payment side, the more detail, the better. And that's why we like the online form, because you can actually load up remittance advice or other documentation with that. I think on the Univita issue, Bobby Lally and folks with the Florida Home Care Association have been really helpful, again, in kind of getting folks to focus on using the complaint hub. I did get the actually saw the dog mauling complaint, and I will tell you, right, the first thing that I did is I put it in the hub, right, so that people could address that, because I kind of feel if things are waiting on me to move, boy, that's not probably a good situation to be in, right? People are really good about bringing stuff to our attention, particularly things that are disturbing or egregious. They do come up. We have a whole kind of protocol for escalating complaints. But we want to make sure that they're handled. And that's why we have staff on the front line that actually can respond to these things. We do actually categorize our complaints into kind of a high, medium, and low. About 14, 15% of our complaints are categorized as high. We try to keep that kind of a fairly, about half are high and medium. Try to keep that high fairly reasonable, because high means we need to act right now. I mean, somebody has a needs a service they're not getting, and we want those right in the queue for folks to work them immediately. If we have a few days, hey, I'm going to run out of medication, you know, in 5 days, that would generally be a medium complaint for us. We have some time to work. But the high for us means we have to work this right now. We have to get on the issue right now. Most of the payment, this might not be happy to for some folks to hear in this room, most of the payment issues with providers are categorized by us as low level and go to our office in Fort Lauderdale. Not always. If we have issues where, and this happens, I'm having payment issues and I'm going to stop providing services, that would kind of move up in terms of the escalation, right? Not that anybody would say that, right? Okay. So where were we? So services. Services is fairly broad listing. You can see some of the subcategories on the monthly report. And again, these are where it could be a denial of prior authorization, coverage issues, I think was mentioned earlier in some of the comments. You know, the plan doesn't says we don't cover this. That's a fairly easy thing for us to deal with in terms of complaints to compliance. We know whether it's covered on the Medicaid program or not. And we do see that people get bad information from customer service representatives. Sometimes in our other category, people might complain about our own staff or our contracted staff, the enrollment broker. So we know that customer services representatives sometimes don't give the right information. I guess that just goes to prove, again, based on some of the earlier comments, that within each organization, not necessarily everybody's on with the program, I guess. That was kind of a reference to the please use the complaint hub. Okay. So you see a lot of things. I will call your attention to one area, and this is going back, I'm sorry to flip you back, but to the detailed report, the monthly report, because it was mentioned earlier. We have had, again, transportation, not only some of the issues, particularly around ambulance, which, again, has been significant, as Beth mentioned, most of the issues we have heard, because folks have, Brian and others, have done actually a really good job using the complaint hub, I will say, and calling things to our attention. Payment, but non-emergency transportation, again, has been an area that you can see is fairly significant portion of the service issues. So we do kind of, we have started tracking that discreetly. If you look at scheduling transport, yeah, underneath the service, sorry, it's a little bit buried, right? And some things will stand out to you there. We have already had a sanction of one managed care plan in this area. And kind of based on these numbers, let me just leave it at that. Okay. That was a previous one. We're looking into some of these right now. Again, kind of making the point there that we do look for trends. So I think there's two aspects to the complaint process for us. Is we're trying to resolve an individual issue, right, initially, first and foremost. Sometimes when there is something that, again, is egregious and standout, it may result in a compliance action. With things like transportation, it often takes a lot more in terms of determining kind of what's underlying the complaint and gathering information. So we tend to look for trends. So you can probably, based on these numbers, imagine which plan we're focused on this particular month that may be having some further conversation with the agency. So we try to look at trends, right, and kind of really drill in on what's going. What do these numbers show us? Where should we be looking? Again, deeper, because it often requires that deeper dive. We did, with regard to transportation, include in the contract amendment that was effective. Help me out, Beth. The SMMC contract amendment. That we do have some liquidated damages or specific monetary damages included in the contract for transportation-related issues. So missing, failing to pick someone up for an appointment. Again, those are new and really kind of grew out of kind of our monitoring of that particular issue. Okay, I'm going to move very quickly and just hit network adequacy here. These, again, are detailed. You can see this is the 244 is a quarterly number, but you can see the details for the month of September on the report. This, Dr. Payne, is where we do that call behind or secret shopping, right? When we get a complaint to say, are you really in the network? Are you accepting new patients? Again, as we get those specific complaints to say, hey, I called and the doctor said he's not really in the network or not accepting new patients, but I was told by the customer service representative that he was. I need to give a shout out to Florida Legal Services and just kind of let you know they we've had some discussion on this issue, I think, for a number of months, and they did a phenomenal exercise study in terms of looking at the plans networks. And this was information online available in their directory, and actually doing those kind of a very systematic follow-up call behind for providers in this case psychiatrists in Region 11, okay, which showed not only do customer services provide bad information, but sometimes plans actually publish bad information. Again, so there's some dialogue happening right now, but it was a phenomenal effort. I know a lot of work, Amy, on your part, but just incredibly, incredibly helpful kind of approach to that. So again, that's one aspect of looking at network adequacy, which is that, again, kind of secret shopper activity. That is really in addition to the ongoing reports and geo-mapping that looks at time and distance. There's a lot of different ways that we need to look at network adequacy to determine really if recipients are getting the type of access they need. Okay, let me just jump to the issues list. This is just kind of an array of issues. This is, as you know, we measure issues. This is the second graph on MMA. This is kind of plan-specific information. And we measure it in a per 1,000, right, issues received per 1,000 plan enrollees, and that way it kind of normalizes the data across all plans. So just how do you read this, right? The lower the number, the less complaints per 1,000 that the plan received. So on the, you know, best performing side of it, all the way to the right, South Florida Community Care Network that had 0.3 complaints per 1,000 enrollees. Okay, then you have to the left side of the graph, you have the plans that are not performing as well in regard as measured by complaints. Okay, so we did play around and put some stars over top of this, but decided not to present it that way. But again, I think we've done a lot. We've done a lot of work in trying to get the classification more crisp. Well, you've been very patient as we brought information. You've seen a couple different looks at it. So we're still working. I think we're better. We're not quite there yet in talking to folks on the ground how this might be most useful from a consumer perspective, but it certainly has this the potential as we continue to work with all of you in terms of how we make this information more meaningful. Just then real quickly, you see the same thing on long-term care, so a breakout for the long-term care program where we have both the issues, again, payment being the number one issue there, and the issues per 1,000 members. Okay, so you can see that. I think we'll take questions or comments from the group.
Dr. Payne,
as a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, that's star one. Record your name, followed by the pound sign, to pose a question or a comment.
Do we, Carla, do we have any members on the phone, members of the committee on the phone?
Ms. Pierce is the best.
Okay. All right, great. Go ahead, Dr. Payne.
Just if you notice on the report for September, talking about the complaints, the committee must be doing a good job because there are no marketing violations.
And thank you all for your service.
Kudos to the committee.
Absolutely, and thank you all for the work that you're doing. And that is something that for the members of the audience may not know, that the members of the committee are reviewing marketing materials that come in from the plans on a regular basis. So we know that's a lot of work. We appreciate that. David, do you want to talk about any kind of marketing things that you're seeing? You may not be seeing a lot of complaints, but we are seeing
I do.
Some interesting monitoring.
Yeah, we're also doing secret shopper in the marketing area. So we have staff that are deployed in the field and that actually go out to marketing events by the plans, right? We call it secret shopping, but it doesn't really matter if they're known or not. But they look, again, do they have appropriate materials that the committee has reviewed. These are, you know, approved marketing materials. Are they using something that no one has seen before? Also, are they using licensed agents? So we have had compliance actions that have resulted out of those secret shoppers for marketings, even though we've not had any complaints generated from recipients or providers. We have had a couple of actions over the last 3 months, I think, for marketing.
Dr. Becker, go ahead.
I've got a couple of questions, and hopefully we can go in a sequence that kind of makes sense. But The first thing for clarification, I think I asked this previously, but maybe for the benefit of others that weren't here. When someone calls in, for instance, a provider's office may, with one call, have multiple issues because they have multiple patients, or a patient may have multiple issues within the management of that one patient. So how is that accounted for in your numbers?
It's a very good question, Dr. Thacker. In these numbers that we're looking at today for the first quarter of state fiscal year 15-16, they are counted as individual issues. Okay, if they're recipient call, beneficiary calls, and they have, I'm having trouble with home health and I can't get also this type of specialty care, right? Those would be actually represented as two separate issues here. And the health track system that I referenced earlier is set up to do that, to take multiple issues. Previous to that, before we went live with that system, which I want to say, well, I don't know why I'm looking at Beth, was probably late in 2014, early 2015. The previous system that we used as we went through rollout was not as accommodating. So we had we captured them as separate issues when we could, but I don't feel completely confident that, again, based on the way the system really didn't help us out that way. But we know in this case the system is set up to do that. I'm not completely confident, Dr. Thacker, and I was just talking earlier today with folks that work in our complaint hub in the complaint center down in Fort Myers. I think there may still be some staff training issues to make sure that we know what the system can do and people aren't locked into an old mindset of what the limitations of what the previous system, and that we're capturing all those multiple issues. But this should reflect, again, each of those as distinct issues.
Good. Thank you, David. And then next question is, and it's probably more of a comment from a provider standpoint, is that I totally understand and agree with how you would triage complaints. And so complaints from a provider shouldn't necessarily get, you know, high priority, certainly not over, you know, a beneficiary's needs. I totally understand that. I would just make a comment in that let's keep those numbers reasonable in terms of our turnaround time. You know, as you look down your column for median days for resolution, I don't think anything's, you know, horrible, but certainly I believe almost in every instance, you know, your provider resolution time is longer than your beneficiary resolution time, and I accept that. I think that's appropriate. So then you would look at and say, well, are there any outliers? And so when you have Prestige Health Choice, that seems to be an outlier in terms of resolution. So what would, and I don't like to single somebody out, but that's what we're doing here in the committee with this individual report, is who stands out and who's doing well and who's out of the, you know, two standard deviations, so to speak, right? And so is there any comment into why one entity would stand out over another?
Doctor, I think your observation is right on point. And if you look, if you kind of peel back to the payment numbers, too, in the more detail, you'll probably see that stand out. There's a couple of plans that are at the higher end of the scale that we talked about in the complaints per 1,000. All first of all, there's kind of a correlation, if you look at it, between the resolution time and the volume of complaints for a particular plan, so you can kind of see that trend. But then if you look at the ones that are on the kind of the left side of the performance scale, have higher numbers of complaints per 1,000, they tend to have very high proportion of payment issues, right? And Prestige, that you pointed out, as I think, I haven't actually done the math, but probably has the highest ratio of payment to other issues, I think. Again, not having done the math here in my head, but certainly they have a higher number based on their their enrollment than other plans do. That we're hopeful, as you know, that there's been some changes with Prestige, where Florida True Health took a majority share in that entity. Florida True Health obviously has a different relationship with AmeriHealth Caritas, that is the claims administrator, third-party administrator for Prestige as a health plan. They're in a bit of transition right now, but I think certainly in our discussions through that transition, we are hoping that will have an impact on that area, and that as we as you see these numbers over the coming months, I would say, hopefully to see that coming down. But you're exactly right, that it's a bit of an outlier at present.
Thank you. And you know, just another comment along that line. So when you look at the number of issues, say, between Prestige and Staywell, they're about the same number. But when you look at the beneficiaries enrolled, Staywell has more than twice the number. So, you know, that's why that stands out, you know, to me. The other thing, David, in the sense that I'm not sure, maybe I'm looking at it wrong, but it seems to me when we compare the two forms, and you have the one in the graph form there, and you compare the raw numbers on this one where, SMMC managed, medical assistance. But if you look under United, and that's in your top column, the last entity there. So if you look up the number of enrollees, over 277,000, and then you look at the number of issues received, for the last 3 months, it doesn't quite, I don't see how that correlates in that United would be, have the highest number on your graph. I'm not sure, I'm probably comparing apples to oranges, but on the one graph, it looks like United's having the most issues per 1,000 members, but when I look at the other one, that doesn't jive. They've got 281 issues, maybe I'm doing the math wrong. I'm trying to figure out.
277,000 enrollees.
Right, and 277,000 enrollees, and I'm not sure if that, correlates exactly.
Maybe.
Those are the numbers, though, that are representing the graph.
Yeah, it's very good. And, Dr. Thayer, I appreciate the way you're looking at it. I should mention on the Prestige that we just, the compliance action just went out last week. Again, related to some of the complaints, particularly regarding provider payment there. But I think it's hard to exactly do the math back because the membership will change every month. But I think the general concept worked out right there. About the fourth highest in number of issues received last 3 months, right under Sunshine with 284, and United has 281. But if you look at the membership for those four plans, again, just for this 1 month, this doesn't necessarily adequately reflect changes from July and August. But as you mentioned, Dr. Thacker, United has 277 compared to 277,000 members compared to Sunshine with 424, Prestige with 313, Humana 327, and then obviously Staywell with 600. Right, so I think when you take the membership, it that kind of normalizes it. Although again, I don't think we can do the math without seeing the membership month over month.
Okay, I just wanted to be clear. I didn't pull out a calculator or anything, but I wanted to be sure that those were the numbers that are corresponding to that graph. Like we're in the same real time as best you can.
I hope so. I didn't check the math either, and I hope I won't do it. I won't even attempt to do it in my head. But we'll look at that, right? Because we definitely want this to be accurate, because it is an important metric for us in terms of how to normalize across the different plants so that we can find those outliers that you mentioned.
So we had Stan Whitaker, and then Alan would be next.
David, I just have a process question, actually. I've had some of our members who called into the complaint line or complaint hub and got very good service and very good response back. Their issue, however, could not be resolved with the initial person. So when they talked with them, they said, well, we'll have to bump this up the ladder. And I forget who they said that next person was, some kind of mediator, I think they said, in their issue with that they brought. Now, when the complaint went up to the mediator, and again, there was a very good timely answer back, but it was to the point that it was mentioned to the health plans this particular issue, and there was no follow-up from that. Is that, I mean, I didn't know if it got into a contract area, or how should that be handled when we get up to that mediator status? As do they call us back, or do we know if there's resolution, or is that something that maybe the agency's looking forward to addressing in another contract arrangement, or how would we get feedback from that?
Yeah, thank you, Sam. That's a very good question, too. I'm not sure about the mediator. I'm assuming that maybe the reference there is to the contract manager, those staff within the agency that actually have responsibility for managing the contract with the specific health plan. We have a contract manager for each of the health plans. It could be, again, I'll make that distinction between the individual issue where, again, we're trying to move the individual issue, the frontline folks that are working with the beneficiary, the provider, trying to move that towards resolution. And I think either Dr. Thacker or Dr. Payne maybe alluded to this. Resolution is kind of a difficult thing to define, and we've had a lot of discussion with a lot of different folks from a lot of different perspectives, including the health plans, because as you can see, and we tried to note this on the report, that median days to resolution is really until we can call back and close the loop with a complainant, beneficiary, provider to say, are things taken care of, right, to your satisfaction, kind of, sort of, right? But I would tell you, and Brian could tell you, no, Brian's still here, right? Then on the mileage issue, right, for billing, there is no resolution. I mean, if it's not in the contract, it's not, the plans aren't paying it. I don't know that we're ever going to resolve every issue to the complainant's satisfaction, okay? So that becomes really challenging. One of the things that we do in the escalation is what we call it to the contract manager, if plans aren't responsive, then that generally gets escalated. We're trying to make sure that gets escalated, okay? And we've had those issues. And then, again, we try to have the contract managers use these tools to go in and look for specific trends, right, that can generate compliance actions. What's happening with the payment, you know, provider payments with this plan because the numbers look really high compared to everyone else? What's happening with transportation in this particular plan because those numbers are twice as high as any other plan, right? So that's how the contract managers work on an ongoing basis. They meet every week. They look at detailed reports of this on a weekly basis, but they use these tools to kind of help guide them to that. But they really also get involved, I think, in the situations that you described, when a plan is not being responsive and our line staff that work with providers and beneficiaries have to say, I'm just not getting any, kind of reaction or response from the plan.
And that's exactly what happened. So it goes to the manager, the plan manager, and the plan manager gets back with the provider, or does the original contact person get back with a provider? I'm a little unsure about that. Or how does that work?
The staff, the agency staff that are working with either the provider or the recipient will get back, will close the loop, or should close the loop, again, assuming that everybody's with the program, right? Should be closing the loop with the provider or the beneficiary. The contract manager is talking to the plan. And generally not the day-to-day contacts for within the health plans that are working on complaints and issues and providing provider services, but generally at the executive level to say, hey, you know, what's going on? We need to be responsive. That's where we often see, as kind of Amy alluded to, issues where some of the line staff with the plans, the customer service representatives, have just got it wrong. You know, and the contract managers have to engage the plan and say, why are your people saying this, right? And the plans have to kind of go down, you know, the ladder and get folks corrected. We saw that actually a lot. I mentioned the Univita situation earlier that kind of blew up, so to speak, at the end of July. We saw that a lot in terms of the information or the misinformation that happened kind of at the frontline level, and our need to engage plan to say, you got to correct that, you know, the messaging that's going out to the provider community.
Hello, David, Ellen Anderson with the Florida Hospital Association. Just a couple of things. As far as consistency with the complaint process, I think for the hospital community, it would be very helpful to have that, like what the complaint process is actually going to be, because similar to what Dr. Thacker said, so we're a large provider, so if we have many complaints under, you know, one hospital here, one hospital is being told in one part of the state to gather a spreadsheet together and then turn that in, then another hospital in another part of the state is just being told to go ahead and type in absolutely every single complaint that they have. So it's very time consuming. They're doing it, but hospitals throughout the state are being told to do two different things. So maybe having and working alongside you all to have some sort of consistent policy and process as to how they can best get to a resolution, because the perception is that some of these issues are not actually getting resolved and they're continuously having to upload complaints over and over again, and that are very similar in nature. The other issue that we are having a lot, that we're hearing from a lot of our members, happens to be on the individual plan policies and procedures are causing delays in care for the patients. So as much as we would love to work directly with the health plan, which we do, that isn't always our best avenue to get that resolution. So part of that needs to be, I understand that you said earlier, if it's a beneficiary problem, in order to get a faster resolution, to actually call. But just imagine in real time what that would be like, who from the hospital, you know what I mean, would actually call for that beneficiary. The care for the beneficiary is still getting delayed. So maybe having a protocol there as well, but something that is consistent for all hospitals to use, for the staff at, you know, the Florida Hospital Association to share with our members and say, here's the protocol, here's what you need to do, rather than having, you know, a little bit of hodgepodge, you know, of turning things in would be helpful.
Thanks, Ellen. There's a lot there. Celeste, when are we working on the how-to? Soon, right? Like next week. Okay. So I think there is a need to get some information out. I mentioned a couple things. Calling won't delay it. The folks on the phones will put it in the same system that the online form is going to feed into. So it won't delay it. It only in some circumstances. Maybe not if you're having trouble with, you know, getting a discharge or getting, again, medical equipment or home health set up for a discharge. I don't think they'll resolve that on the spot. But if it's like, I had a bad experience with the enrollment broker for choice counseling and I really wanted to change plans, they could do that on the spot as opposed to someone going online and having an email. So it's not in every situation, but it can help. In terms of the consistency, let me say that unlike kind of pre-SMMC world, not all, but most of our functional areas, which is now how the Division of Medicaid is organized, which is also how our website is organized, which may get to another of Amy's comment that I'll leave alone for right now. But that we've consolidated function. So all of that interaction with providers about what to send is not varying by office. It's all done in the same office in Fort Lauderdale. Okay. What likely would happen, I think, is two different things. One is, again, the difference between rollout and how we handled it, and now our look at compliance and where the situation is different. If we're looking at spreadsheets, that's probably because we're probing very hard on compliance issues and need a certain level of detail to press the case with the plan to say you're not meeting your contract expectations. Okay, so you might see us handling it differently depending on where we are in the process and what type of issue we think we're looking at, right? And we see the gamut. We see provider billing issues, you know, where the provider needs training or needs to know how to contact or, you know, so you see that on one end of the spectrum, and then we see, again, compliance issues where the plan is just not paying correctly and appropriately. So that guides us in terms of how we handle it. The other thing that's important, and I recognize the burden, and I think, again, some how-to would be really helpful. So I think your basic point is right on target. But we also, when we see the similar issues recurring, and maybe there's some confusion, it sounds like, in terms of duplicate and repeating and reoccurring issues, because our experience has been, if you think about it, when we get issues in, right, we try to address those specific issues. So if we're reaching out to the plan and we're pushing on the plan and we're seeing that those particular, let's say, provider payment in this case, claims get paid, okay, does that really resolve the issue or does that just get those particular claims paid, right? Right. So again, we're wanting to see. We need to kind of tease out that issue between duplicate issues and reoccurring issues, and whether again we've solved the individual issue or the individual issue has been resolved, or whether there is an underlying issue that has yet to be resolved. So we have a lot of work to do, and we can improve for sure, but I think those are some of the dynamics that we're trying to deal with.
Right, and I think the hospital community is very eager to work alongside the agency to kind of figure out that process to best, you know, handle it, but I do think at the heart of the matter is that we don't have, like, an actual definition for resolution, so the perception is that some of these issues actually are not getting resolved, and so they are re-entering, and, you know, then it looks like on your side duplication, rather on their side it's just that the issue was never resolved. Make sense?
Absolutely. I mean, I could tell you that a good example, again, is the spike that I kind of referenced with regard to Univita's exit from the market, you know, that caused a lot of, first of all, and I should let you know, in terms of just a compliment to our folks, the folks down in Fort Myers worked for 3 weekends, right, to make sure that they were there to man the online form if something came up into the web in terms of service issues, right? But we didn't know what the resolution was. So we had this big spike, particularly in provider issues and provider payment issues, and we didn't know what the resolution was, right? So we're struggling with the same thing. What does resolution actually mean? What we're trying to drive towards, what we're trying to make the distinction in the way we work these issues and use these tools, is to make sure that we can identify what we would call, again, potential compliance issues, right? And it's kind of similar how we look at fair hearings, which if you think about it, it's just kind of like an Uber complaint maybe, right? Is there a compliance? Has the plan done the right thing or not met expectations under the contract, right? Teasing those out are not always, you know, it's not always an easy thing to do. But that's kind of how we're trying to look at that and trying, you know, to get the contract managers involved in that look behind of this information to see if we have, again, the failure to meet contractual obligations versus we know it's hard, again, particularly for provider communities that haven't dealt with managed care, not really applicable to the hospitals, right? Or when you have situational issues like Univita, right, that show up, we know it's hard, and we're going to see complaints, and we're going to have to work those. But we're trying to do a better job, again, of again, it's the accountability that Beth mentioned earlier, that Justin always talks about, to make sure that we can tease out, again, where the plan's not doing what they should be doing under their contract, and kind of hold folks accountable for that.
We're almost at 3 o'clock, and I know a lot of folks here are here to go to the subcommittees as well. So I'm going to suggest we move on from this topic. So it's pretty much a standing agenda item at this time. So we do have one more committee business, which is the bylaws update. Carl, I'll turn it over to you to walk us through that.
I have to turn on my mic. Committee members have had an opportunity to look at the proposed amendments to the bylaws. The bylaws were last amended in September of 2013, and a number of changes have become necessary. So changes were provided to members, proposed changes, and most of the individuals that reviewed the changes had no problems with them. However, we did have a few changes that were added very late on Friday afternoon, or proposed very late on Friday afternoon, by one of our committee members. So the minutes as you see them right now are not the latest changes that individuals have asked to be made. As you notice in the information you were provided, we did make just very minor changes in, rather than saying Medicaid, we added Division of Medicaid. We added a deletion of the special terms and conditions numbers. Since those change on a somewhat regular basis, we didn't want to have numbers associated with the special terms and conditions in the event that they changed and we somehow missed making a change in the number. We also asked that we add the term past beneficiaries to the bylaws to allow individuals who have at some point been beneficiaries participate on the committee. We have had two members that have had to drop off of our committee recently because for one reason or another they no longer meet eligibility criteria. However, they continue to understand what the plight of being a beneficiary is, and they can certainly speak to the issues that we've asked them to speak to on this committee. So we've asked that we add past beneficiaries as members of the committee. And then finally on page one, we have also added the Florida Department of Elder Affairs to the list of members. We have treated them as members for the entirety of the committee's establishment, but we have never had them actually as an actual member in our bylaws. On page two, we have also added Division of Medicaid rather than just Medicaid, and then taking out Director rather than the Medicaid Director, we've added the Deputy Secretary for Medicaid. Under Section 5, again, we have taken out the Special Terms and Conditions numbers to make it easier to review going forward, as those numbers may change at some point. And then under Article 3, Section 4, we had a question about what majority actually was when we say the majority of the committee votes on a particular issue. And our numbers change from time to time. So we thought that by adding in the majority of the current membership of the committee, so that whether the committee now has 12 members or 15, it would be the majority of those members voting on an issue to pass a particular issue. The question that came up late on Friday afternoon from one of our members was that there might need to be an actual definition put in of what a quorum is. So if we need to add that rather than simply that it is the majority of the current membership, we can do that as well. On page three, we again added, took out Medicaid program and added agency under Section 5. Under Section 6, the question came up also on Friday afternoon from one of the members that they would like to know if, rather than just submitting a change to the agenda prior to the meeting, was all that could happen, or if we could add a last-minute change at the discretion of the chair of the committee. And then under Section 6, or Article 6, Section 1, again, we had had language in there, or proposed language in there, relating to the past membership, but the actual language for establishment of the subcommittees does not allow for that. They have specific language, so we took out the proposed language that one of our members had added, and we went back to the language that was there originally. And then finally, under Section 3, we took out the special terms and conditions numbers again. On the last page, page 4, again, under Section... I'm sorry.
So I think we're all missing every other page.
Oh, no.
I think we have... Yeah, I've been trying to follow as well.
Yay!
So... We don't have any additional copies that have all the pages. No.
Well.
Okay. I think the thing is, her copy has front and back.
Yeah. Yes. I was trying to figure that out, how we got this, but yes.
I had two different people making copies for me, and apparently one made back and front, and one made front.
Make sure the voting numbers go.
That work? Sorry about that. Now that I'm finished, I have a
question.
Sure.
Do all the voting members of the committee have the full copy in front of them? Okay, very good. Well,
what's in there you have all seen. The information that is provided to you as you see it right now is what you've reviewed. You've had it for a month and a half or so to review. So I would like to propose sending you out the information that was provided to me and the recommendations that were provided to me late Friday afternoon, so that you can review those if you then choose to have that added to the bylaws. Then we'll do that and vote on them at the next meeting, if that's okay with everybody.
So to be clear, that just to make sure everyone's on the same page now that we have all the pages, that we're proposing that this that these changes that are in front of you now be voted on, that the additional suggestions that came in later that the committee has not had a chance yet to review would be sent out to you, and if it's your pleasure to add those to the bylaws, we will do that at a subsequent meeting. That would give everybody a chance to kind of look at them and deliberate on them. We are interested in going ahead and getting these done this meeting. I do want to check, Carla, do we have a quorum at this time?
Yes,
okay, we do.
Okay.
I will then make a motion that we accept the bylaws as submitted.
Thank you. Do I have a second?
Second.
Okay. Any discussion?
I do have a comment in the sense that for this meeting, we want to make sure that we're not voting and making decisions unless we've truly established, you know, an adequate number of representatives. And, you know, I can foresee a potential situation. I mean, I barely made this meeting today, but I can see a potential situation where we may not have any medical providers here, yet voting could still go forth if we're going to accept a quorum as a simple majority. And if you can accept that this meeting will go forth with a quorum. Okay, and what is our number of members, 12 or 14?
12.
So you can have 7 people show up, and then, you know, a majority vote is 4 people, and you may not even have, any medical providers, essentially. And so that's my concern, is whether, and that's something for us to think about and chew on, you know, is that something we would want to go, you know, forward with those kinds of numbers, so... Something okay. to think about, and that's why I wanted that defined.
Okay. Ellen, and then Jennifer?
Under the Article 3, Section 6, I like the idea of adding at the discretion of the chair, for what it's worth. I know that we're going to probably vote on that at the next one, but just wanted to put on the record today that I like that idea.
Okay. Jennifer?
The
I just wanted to check, since we were still going, not for today, but for the future, we were going to accept additional comments. If we look at these today and we see something we didn't see earlier, can we still submit that, or do we need to talk about it today?
No, I think we can, for any subsequent, any changes, we can vote on it, these changes today with any changes that are motioned by this group and accepted by this group. I mean, if you feel comfortable adding things to this, to these bylaws at this time, we could do that. I think just in the interest of time and the ability for everybody to kind of think it through, probably I would suggest that we wait on any additional changes, but we can bring it to the next meeting. There's no limit to the number of times we can look at the bylaws, and there's something about, you know, you always see something new. So.
I'm prepared to vote today, but just something to think about that I didn't see, like, until today, even though I read it, you know, twice. I agreed with adding past beneficiaries, but I wonder if we should put some parameters on that so that someone's experience does not date their comments. If I was a beneficiary 20 years ago, I don't know that my experience is relevant to current discussion.
If you have a suggestion on kind of what that time frame might be, we did talk about that when we were putting this in, but couldn't arrive at a conclusion.
2 years?
Okay.
Just a point of order. Since this committee works under Robert's rules, I believe Robert's rules calls for any change of the bylaws to be 2/3 majority.
Is it in the bylaws that we operate by Robert's rules? Apologize.
Yes.
Okay. We're going to have to, we'll have to check that then. Would you then be suggesting that we table this and bring it?
No, I think we have a quorum here. So of the voting members, if we had 2/3, okay. that vote
oh,
would
just
be.
Oh, would the vote would be a 2/3
yes.
majority.
Vote has okay. to be 2/3 majority.
Not a simple majority. Okay. That would be helpful, and that may be something we want to consider clarifying in the bylaws, just that we don't have to reference back to Robert's rules of order in the future. Okay. Is there further discussion, Amy? Yes.
And just to follow up Jennifer's comment about the past beneficiaries, after rereading it several times, I realized that there were some specific requirements under the special terms and conditions, specifically term 41 that says that we have to have at least 4 beneficiaries at all time, but then it goes on to say that the state may submit for justification from CMS and get an exception to that, and it does say beneficiaries not past. Is this something that we would have to request an exception from CMS?
We could look into that. We've not had to do that yet. I think the idea behind that was that finding beneficiaries who are able to serve, given life circumstances, and have the interest in serving, if their experience is recent enough to be useful, to, you know, inform the debate, that it would be worth having that. So we can take a look at that, though.
Okay.
Madam Chairman, call the
yes.
question.
Okay. All right. We have a motion and a second. All those in favor, actually, we'll probably need you to raise your hand so we can count the votes. All those in favor, raise your hands, please. Okay. And it's unanimous, so the motion carries. Thank you. But thank you for being our parliamentarian as well.
Madam Chairman, that actually was out of order because you have to ask if the question should be called first before you vote.
Okay. All right. Apologize. I do informal orders, so okay. So I have to ask for, say that again, please.
You have to ask if the question should be called. You should vote immediately.
Okay. So
all in favor of voting immediately, please raise your hand. Is what you should say.
All those in favor of voting immediately, raise your hand, please.
Okay.
That is unanimous.
Now
we can have the vote. Okay.
Yes.
So all those in favor, please raise your hand. Thank you. The motion carries. Thank you for keeping us in order. And I'm going to task Carla with studying Robert's Rules of Order and keeping us straight next time. I don't think Justin knows that well either. Okay. That concludes the regular business of the committee. It is now...
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm sorry, do we have a couple of minutes to revisit some of the questions that we didn't get through on the amendments? I think on the first portion.
Yes, I think if we could take maybe 5 or 10 minutes on that. There are a number of people I know and quite a full agendas in the subcommittees as well.
Totally
they're only noticed till 4. So.
I appreciate your indulgence, and I'd come late, but towards the end enough to be able to formulate a question in regards to the amendments in regards to express enrollment. And so individuals are mandated to participate and will be enrolled in an MMA plan immediately after Medicaid eligibility determination. And so, and they have 120 days thereafter to change plans. So I wasn't sure on how they were assigned to what entity they were assigned to.
So they'd be assigned the same way they are now, which David might be able to describe better than I can, the exact order, but... it's generally a round robin among the plans, and so there are some other considerations that we take into effect if we have some knowledge of their history. David, do you want to address those briefly? Okay, good.
Bill Roberts.
Too late.
Roberts Rules of Order.
Giving them to Carla.
I notice there's a lot of dust on that book.
Dr. Thacker, it is the same as it is now. It just happens sooner. But so if we have information on their primary care provider, that's included in the algorithm for assignment. Also, we look at plan relationships. So if they're already enrolled in a long-term care plan, for example, that would be a factor in the assignment to an MMA plan. Again, an assignment happens only if an individual doesn't choose, as you know. Or, again, if they have a, if they're enrolled in a MMA, Managed Medical Assistance Plan, that's a factor for long-term care. We also look at their Medicare plan. Should they be in a Medicare Advantage, managed care plan? Again, is that the same as the MMA plan? So those are the big ones that would drive it. They're the same variables that we look at now. Just we'll look at them again immediately following eligibility.
Thank you. And I had just a general type of comment from a provider standpoint. And certainly I'm about the beneficiaries, but I do feel obligated to bring up some provider issues and comments when appropriate. And I would say that we need to encourage more primary care involvement. I'm a primary care physician as an internist. But one of the things that limits primary care docs from getting involved is that they need help from the whole house of medicine. And that includes the full spectrum of a specialist referral, but even more pressing to us in this area of Tallahassee as an internist who also takes care of people in the hospital, I have a lot of issues getting folks into home health care or getting them into a skilled nursing facility. And it's very difficult. It seems to be a little bit time-consuming. I think it's very easy for someone to say, oh, yes, we have long-term care benefits with a 40% copay, and so that's, $450 a day or whatever it is, it gets to be, it's one thing to say we have that coverage. It's another thing in the practical reality to be able to utilize it and access it. And so that's just one issue of why primary care docs don't want to either enroll or are telling you that we don't want to take any new patients. We can't handle anymore because we cannot adequately cover the folks that we have. And more often than not, these folks are fairly high utilizers with complex issues that we need assistance. We need to refer them and to specialists. And if you don't have that that full spectrum, then the primary care doc's left holding the bag, so to speak. And so that's the things I just I'm going to harp on a little bit because I think we still have some work to do in that arena. So thank you.
Great. Well, I appreciate that, and we have worked very hard to increase the network of specialists. I think it's probably as good as it's ever been, but it can always be improved. I do just want to clarify, just so that nobody's confused, that there are no 40% copays in Medicaid. Nominal copays only for adults, not for children, not for pregnant women on pregnancy-related services. So, just in case that was confusing.
Yeah, there's out-of-pocket costs and things to folks, but the main
in commercial plans, yes, and in Medicare, yes. I just want to be real clear that in Medicaid, that's not the situation.
Right, and thank you for clarifying that. What's worse is that a lot of folks won't take the Medicaid folks at all, let alone offer them a copay. So that's, to me, that's worse.
And that is what we're working with on the network adequacy standards, all the things we've talked about to make sure the networks are robust, they're real. They're taking, that meaning they're taking people. Jennifer, go ahead.
I just had three questions earlier that I didn't, you know, express to make room to give time for the public testimony. But on page 13, where we talked about the physician and dental provider participation, I'm not familiar with the difference between enrolled and registered.
Okay.
Somebody tell me?
Sure. So enrolled is fully enrolled in Medicaid, meaning that they can provide services to people who are fee-for-service and bill Medicaid directly to our fiscal agent for that. Registered means that they are that we have knowledge of them, that we've done some basic work, background work on them, but they are only serving under managed care plans. They are not able to provide services and bill for fee-for-service Medicaid recipients.
Okay. Thank you. And on page 22, when we talked about the HEDIS measures, for example, for fiscal year 14, we had the 55, the 10, and the 20%, which adds up to 85. Do you know what's not on these charts on the HEDIS measures?
Which ones were not at or above the national mean?
Yeah, right. In 2013, it's 29 and 12 for a total of 41 on at the mean or better. So I'm thinking, was it 59% under? But then in the third chart, it's 55, 10, and then it says, well, under was 20.
Which chart are you on? I just now
page
found
22.
Okay. Okay, so this is the... the percentage of our measures, we currently have 51 HEDIS measures that we have our plans report. That has varied over the years, but currently it's 51. This is the percentage of the measures that were at or above the national mean for that particular measure, so comparing to other Medicaid plans nationally. So the 20%, is yours in color? Mine's not in color.
Just the numbers don't add up.
So there are some that are... Okay, so the ones that are not on here are the ones that were below the national mean and did not improve or actually declined from 2013 to 2014. So the remaining percentage are the ones that did not do better. So the green at the top, those are the ones that are above the national mean. The blue is at the national mean. The 20% beige-ish color are ones that were below the national mean, but trending upwards, and the ones that are not on here, which...
The ones that are not on there are just plain mean.
Were ones we're not proud of, so did improve or went down.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. Okay, anything else for the good of the order? Okay, with that, I will take a motion to adjourn. We have a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Okay. Second. Okay. Without objection, we'll say the meeting adjourned. Carla, do you want to tell people which meeting rooms we'll be in for the subcommittees?